Welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 21st of February 2022 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. We've been away for a couple of weeks, but now we are back and we have an exciting show in store for you today. And of course, I am joined by my co-host here, Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing? Did you manage to survive the awful weather over the weekend?
Yes, I did. Fortunately, I mean, the weather was nowhere near as severe as it was suggested it would be. I've always found, actually, that when you get these dire weather reports that come through, that they rarely are as bad as people suggest. Now, I can remember lots of occasions where there's been snow over the winter time, and they've said, you know, unless it's absolutely necessary, don't leave your house. And on very many of those occasions, because I've had work commitments, I've had to leave the house. I've left the house and then found that it's been sort of pretty easy to get around, really. And it was difficult to, on those occasions, to understand why there was such widespread panic and so many people cried off and stayed in their homes. But I think that it's all part and parcel of this tendency to babyfy people and to make people less self-reliant and less determined and assertive, I suppose.
Well, what it reminded me of is the fact that they were able to get everybody to stay home for this lockdown. Because this is the first time that I've seen red weather warnings, as it was. We were told it was a red weather warning. Everybody should be staying at home. And the BBC actually had reporters based around the country waiting for the wind to come. I mean, they had some down in Cornwall. They had some in Wales. I think they had some in London. And they were all just sort of waiting there by the beach, waiting for the bad weather to come. And I think then it came and there were a couple of trees were blown down. I think some people were without electric. And of course, that often happens when there's a storm. A tree will fall down and take down the power lines. I saw a quite an endearing video of these youngsters sat on their skateboards, holding up plastic bags as if they were sails, pulling them along on their skateboards. But apart from that, it was really a damp squib. But what it reminded me of was the fact that they were able to get everybody to stay home during the lockdown. And now they were sort of trying to get everybody to stay down because there was this windy weather. As you say, Max, trying to get everybody to just rely on the government rather than relying on their common sense. I mean, it really wasn't that bad where I was. I've seen much worse, much, much worse weather than that.
There were some bits of video that I've seen on the internet where, you know, there were localized places where the wind was very strong and some sort of people who were perhaps elderly or whatever and unsteady on their feet were being blown over. But not sufficient for there to be the sort of red warning and the sort of dire description of what we might expect if we were to go out that we were getting from the news media. I think it was just a bit OTT, really.
Well, it even made international news. I mean, I had someone from America come into the chat room saying, are you all right? You know, we've heard about all this bad weather that's hitting Britain. I was like, well, yeah, I'm fine. It's I think they made a much larger thing of it than necessary, basically. But we've got some other things to talk about. We've also need to be talking about the possibility of the Australia policy of putting illegal asylum seekers into a third country while they wait to have their claims processed. And last week I talked about this in the Daily Nationalist. The Policy Exchange came out with this idea and they suggested that these illegal asylum seekers, illegal immigrants, the ones that try to break in through the channel, that they should be put into a variety of places were suggested. I think Cyprus, the Channel Islands and the South Atlantic. And I thought, well, the South Atlantic sounds like a good idea, but I doubt very much whether the government are going to do this. And you were telling me the government have now got the very man involved with this that was responsible for the Australia policy, which is the one that we want. So can you tell us some more about this and who he is?
Well, this is a chap called Alexander Downer, who is a fairly long-standing politician in Australia. He was very briefly the leader of the so-called Conservative Liberal Party in Australia. He never became the Prime Minister, though. I think he had to step down because of some hoo-ha at some point. But he then did become the Foreign Affairs Minister for Australia between 1996 and 2007. So that's, you know, an 11-year stretch, which is pretty good. And by all accounts, he was the person who was responsible for introducing the turn-back policy that Australia adopted, where instead of allowing boat people and illegal migrants to land in Australia and be housed temporarily in Australia while their cases were heard, he introduced a policy of shipping those people off to islands that were separate from Australia, where they effectively couldn't enjoy the sort of illegal access to Australian society that they had hoped to have, and where they were then kept there until their immigration status was determined and either sent away or accepted as genuine asylum seekers. I think, though, that this to some extent does act as a distraction, though, because the fact of the matter is that let me just say before I talk about that, that the fact that the Policy Exchange, which is a think tank in this country, has produced a report which supports Alexander Downer's policy, where they're suggesting that there should be a two-stage plan adopted by the government. Plan A should be where we try to persuade the French to accept the migrants back. Once we've stopped them in the channel, we should be able to sort of take them back to France and drop them back off in France so that it frustrates their attempts to get into our country legally. But if the French won't play ball, and it appears that they don't want to play ball, then that we should adopt this turn back policy, which is regarded by Policy Exchange and the report that's been done by them as Plan B, and where they're suggesting that the suitable places that the illegal migrants should be taken to are the Channel Islands, where I don't suppose the Channel Islanders would be too happy about that. And you have to be fairly wealthy, actually, to live on the Channel Islands. And so I would imagine that proportionately the inhabitants of the Channel Islands will probably have a bit more political clout than the average sort of small town in the UK. And so therefore, it's likely that the Channel Islands won't be adopted. But sovereign bases in Cyprus have been suggested, or on Ascension Island, and so I wouldn't want to sort of lumber the Cypriots with lots of illegal migrants, and perhaps the Ascension Island would perhaps be the preferred option out of those that have been suggested. Although, you know, you could probably think of the other places that might be more suitable. But as I say, I think this is all a bit of a distraction, really, because these issues only really deal with the people who are the illegal migrants crossing the channel in small boats. It doesn't actually address all the hundreds of thousands of people who are coming into this country each year quite legally, and who are sort of coming through the airports, etc., and are being allowed in because the immigration rules allow them to come in. And, you know, we've had for, you know, perhaps two decades now, a situation where there is an excess of immigrants over emigrants of something like somewhere between 100,000 and 150,000 each year. And this is the main brunt of immigration to this country, which is continuing to transform our society gradually from a first world country into a third world country.
Well, this Alexander Downer, he appears to have been involved in the Australian government the last time they sort of really had a proper Australian government. I think at the same time they had Kevin Rudd as Prime Minister, and he gets asked to speak at Hungary's family positive conference about the need for white families to reproduce and why we should not be allowing immigrants from peoples that are vastly different to ourselves into our countries. So Kevin Rudd would appear to be slightly pro-white, and I think he was in the administration in 2007, so around about the same time that this Alexander Downer was there. And I would hope that he would have a good influence on the British government here and do something about this. The other part of it which interested me was that if these illegal immigrants are found to have a credible asylum claim, then they want to put them in a third country. Even then, they're not going to come to Britain. So it won't just be that they will be put into these holding centres that are not in Britain, but if they are found to have asylum, proper asylum claims, then they're still not going to be coming to Britain. They're going to be going to a third country. And this plan A of theirs, which is to try and turn the boats back, they're obviously not going to be able to do that, to send them back to France. France is obviously not going to agree to that. I think the plan B is the only option that they do have, but it's 10 years too late. I mean, they should have been doing this years ago. And I don't understand why they haven't, because if Australia can do it, then Britain can do it, because Australia is signed up to the same treaties that Britain is. So they should just be getting on and doing that. I mean, it's good that they're suggesting it now. We've been suggesting it for a long time, but we'll have to wait and see, I guess.
Yeah, and the report from the Policy Exchange does point out that this sort of Plan A, Plan B approach is consistent with the Refugee Convention from 1951. So there shouldn't really be any legal challenges, although they do accept in the report that there probably will be some legal challenges to the authorities if this approach is adopted by the by Border Force. So we'll probably have the same sort of challenges as we had over Brexit, where individuals or organisations challenged the legality of government policy, and we'll have the sort of the High Court making decisions about it again. So there are lots of hurdles to be overcome before there's any chance of this becoming an effective policy operated by the government, unfortunately.
Well, that Refugee Convention of 1951, I mean, that was intended to deal with Europeans that needed to claim asylum. And as far as I'm aware, the only country which is actually accepting European asylum seekers is Russia. Over the weekend, lots of ethnic Russians from Luhansk and the Donetsk region were all getting into coaches and heading over into Russia because they said that they were being shelled. And of course, we still have this Ukraine-Russia issue that is going on. And apparently our chief negotiator is Liz Truss, this awful woman who has been put there as a foreign secretary. I must admit, before I had seen that much of her, I thought that she was quite good and she seemed to be quite conservative. And I think she was put forward as a contender to take over from Boris Johnson. And I think he has read those reports and he has thought, you certainly don't want Liz Truss to be taken over as prime minister. I'd better put her in an important position so that people can see what she's like. And she is totally gaffe prone. She just talks in slogans. And I saw an interview with her the other day and she was referring to this. And they were talking about gas and Nord Stream 2 and Russia providing the gas. And if we ended up having a war in Ukraine, Putin would turn the gas off and Britain would have no gas. And of course, this is true. This is why it's so wrong of America to be interfering, because, you know, it could end up leaving the whole of Europe freezing cold. But Liz Truss's response to that was, well, we only get 2% of our gas from Russia. 98% of our gas comes from Europe. And that's absolutely incredible. Where does she think Europe gets their gas from? Europe gets all its gas from Russia. So, I mean, she could not even think further than the fact that she gets the gas from Europe as to where Europe actually gets the gas from. And of course, then that brings up this issue. Well, why aren't we finding our own gas like Russia finds its own gas? Don't we have oil fields? I mean, just what is going on there? And I know that someone was telling you something to do with this the other day, Max, about the gas and the oil. Do you want to bring that up?
That's right. Well, in our government's drive for zero carbon status and all this sort of thing, the oil and natural gas exploitation of the reserves that exist under the North Sea, that's effectively being gradually brought to a halt. So whereas in the past we have sunk wells in order to exploit the oil that exists under the North Sea and in order to exploit the natural gas that exists under the North Sea, and I accept that some of this has dried up now, so it isn't perhaps quite as they're in quite such great volumes as it has been in previous decades. But the fact of the matter is, there still is lots of it there. And the point is that it's government policy, so I'm told, not to sink any more wells. And so where there would in the normal course of events be that one particular well will exhaust the rock strata immediately beneath it, and so that well would then be shifted somewhere else and it would drill down again to another pocket of gas and would then exploit that gas, that's no longer happening. And as each well exhausts the strata immediately beneath it, so that well is then closed down. And so whereas Aberdeen was kind of like a sort of El Dorado for people who were engineers qualified in drilling under the sea, we're now in a situation where there is very high unemployment in Aberdeen, and where lots of the people who previously were enjoying quite sizable salaries for the work that they were doing, providing energy for the nation, those people are now unemployed, and there is no prospect of them finding employment in Aberdeen in the future. And so that, it's a very sad thing. And this really is a continuation of the policy that was pursued by Conservative governments in the past, where there was the miners' strike and the confrontation between the Conservative Party, Margaret Thatcher, and the miners' unions at the time. And the long-term solution to that issue was that the government effectively closed down our coal mining industries on the basis that, first of all, the miners' union were troublesome, and so therefore it got rid of any potential for there to be trouble caused by the miners' unions, but on the basis that it was, from an ecological point of view, from a green issues point of view, it is the best thing to do. And so instead of us digging our own coal out of our own rocky substrata, what we're doing now is, what we have been doing in recent decades, is where insofar as coal has been used for energy generation, that coal has been imported from Poland, where, of course, traditionally Polish workers have had lower salaries than the British coal miners, and so therefore the coal was cheaper. And so that was again seen as an advantage. But now we're in a situation where those coal mines have flooded because they haven't been maintained. So it will cost a heck of a lot to get those coal mines going again in the future, although I still think that may well need to be the case. But we're using the same kind of arguments, the same kind of policies are being transferred over now to North Sea oil and gas. And so we're in a situation where that industry is dying on its feet, which is very, very sad, and which is making us dependent upon foreign countries for our power. There was an article in the news probably about 10 or 15 years ago where the entire nuclear power industry in this country was sold off to a French company who are supported by the French government. And so our nuclear power is in the hands of the French. We're in a situation where we're buying our oil from Europe, who in turn are buying it from Vladimir Putin. So we're in a fairly dicey situation there as a result of the foreign policy pursued by this country. And of course, our coal industry no longer exists. And so we are becoming increasingly dependent upon either nuclear power, which from an ecological point of view is frowned upon, or from renewable sources, which is wave and wind power. Now, the last couple of days have meant that the wind power side of things has actually been a bit of a boost, a bit of a shot in the arm for the energy industry in this country, because the vast number of propellers that, and windmills that we've got off the coast of Norfolk have been going round at a heck of a pace with the 100-mile-an-hour winds. But that's an unusual thing that doesn't happen very often. And so we can't rely upon there being strong winds in the future. And of course, relying on renewable energy means that we're going to have a situation where the energy supply to this country is going to become increasingly precarious. And I noticed that last night that we had a power cut during the late hours of the evening, around about 11:15. The power cut only lasted for 3 minutes, but that was a taster, I think, of what we can expect to happen increasingly in the future as we become more and more dependent upon unreliable sources of energy.
And also, these unreliable sources of energy are costing an absolute fortune. I mean, we've got our own resources here. We had our own coal, had our own gas, had our own oil. Now we're having to import it all from elsewhere. The electricity prices have gone through the roof. I think everybody's being told that there's going to be an extra £600 or more than that, in fact, over £1,000. And the government has said, oh, well, it's OK, because we're going to give everybody a loan of £600. So that's a loan. That's not a grant. That's a loan. Everybody is still going to have to pay that back. Everybody is still going to have to pay this extra money for this energy when we have all this energy that we're sitting on that we just stopped using. It just seems so ridiculous to me that we are no longer self-sufficient when we could be. It's like with the tin as well. I mean, we used to supply all the rest of the world with the tin. I don't know what's happened to the tin mining in Britain. You know, it's incredible, all the resources that we have here in this country, and instead of being self-sufficient, we just rely on these other places. And if you're talking about wanting to be green, I mean, it just offloads that problem to another country, doesn't it? Surely the green types, the environmentalist types, they would prefer to be extracting the coal here in Britain, where we have lots of laws to ensure that it would be done in an environmentally friendly way, instead of getting it from somewhere where perhaps they don't have these laws.
And I was reading a report recently which was saying that electric cars are likely to become the new diesel problem, in that we had a period where the government was encouraging everybody to buy diesel cars because they were allegedly less damaging to the environment than petrol driven cars, and now we've now found out that was a complete lie, that wasn't the case at all, and that diesel cars were the most polluting cars. But nobody's taking into account, with regard to electric vehicles, the cost to the planet as a whole of mining the precious metals that are needed in order to make batteries last longer and make them lighter than they have been in the past. The biggest problem that exists for motor transport, if it's going to be powered by electricity, is the massive weight of the batteries involved. And if you think about electric vehicles that have been used traditionally in our society, then you would realize that milk floats are the model that's been used in the past. And milk floats are very slow and incredibly heavy. And so these are the issues that the motor industry is struggling with: the great weight, the slowness, and the slowness of recharging the vehicles at the end of the day, or when they've outrun the capacity of their batteries to provide power. And the motor industry is trying to make the electric cars lighter. It's trying to extend the range of the batteries, etc. And in order to do this, we're using greater and greater amounts of these precious metals that are primarily mined either from places like Russia, but also from Africa. And there are vast amounts of rock that have to be mined and ground down in order to for the the ore to be extracted so that these precious metals can be created, and so that we can have these batteries, and so that we can also have things like mobile phones. They, you know, they use the same thing, because again, there's this constant drive to make the mobile phones smaller and lighter than they have been in the past. And so the same precious metals are being used in the production of batteries for mobile phones. Well, I think if you take into account the vast amounts of rock that have to be mined and ground using machinery, and the energy that machinery is currently using, which has traditionally been powered by diesel engines, the effect on the world, on the environment and the ecology of the world, is probably going to be quite substantial. And if that's taken into account, we'll probably find that electric cars aren't really any more beneficial for the ecology than petrol cars have been in the past.
Yeah, I think it's lithium and cobalt that they use. And then you've also got to think, well, how are people going to be charging up the electric cars? Well, they're going to be charging them up from the power stations. And we know that we don't have enough environmentally friendly ways to produce that. It ends up being coal that fires these power stations, and then that provides the electricity for the car. And then you think, well, hang on a minute, does the car not itself need to generate electricity? What about the heater for the car? What about the air conditioner for the car? What about all the electrics that you need in a car that are generated by the petrol engine normally? What about people that live in cold countries? I mean, this has been brought up by the guys over there at Nordic Frontier. I mean, you've got your car, which will go for an hour or whatever, but it's probably only going to go for half an hour if you have the heating on. And then you're going to have to think, well, should I be using the heater, or should I be trying to go for as far as I can actually go with the car? And we've already seen this really brought into quite stark view in Texas when they had their recent power cuts. They had huge power cuts. The reason why they had the power cuts is because they'd put all these windmills up, and the windmills failed, and they had freak cold weather that they hadn't had for 100 years. And there just wasn't enough power to keep everybody hot. And all the people that had petrol and diesel cars were able to go out into their car, start the car up, and sit there in the warmth. Everybody that had these electric cars ended up freezing, and people ended up dying because of this. I mean, it really is a back to front way of looking at things. I mean, I've seen a cartoon, and it's got somebody with the it's actually a picture, I think it was, somebody with an electric lawnmower, and then walking along behind them, they've got somebody with a petrol generator in a wheelbarrow with the lead going from the lawnmower to the petrol generator. And that's effectively what it is with these electric cars. It's like Liz Truss not being able to see further than, oh, we get our gas from Europe, and not realising where does Europe get it from. It's the same thing with these electric cars. Oh, well, I get all my power for my car from the electricity. Well, where does the electricity come from? As you pointed out, Max, it comes from rare minerals and these batteries and all the rocks and the damage to the geology that has to be done for that. And then also the actual power itself comes from these diesel power stations. It's all back to front. And I did see something else that was talking about, I think it was hydrogen power, and it was Caterpillar. And they had come up with a new way to get hydrogen from water, basically. And they had actually got one of those JCBs working from this. And they were saying, look, this would be a much better technology to use, not just because the only thing that's produced from it is water, but also because it works on the same principles that petrol and diesel cars work on. So mechanics would not have to completely retrain and learn like you have to do to learn how to use an electric car. It still works on all the same principles that our cars work on at the moment. So, I mean, that could be the technology that overtakes these electric cars. Because I think you're going to be right there, Max, because you've also got the problem of what to do once the cars have broken down. I mean, it costs almost as much to get a new battery as it does to get the car itself. And I've seen, like, these old ship graveyards that you see. There are these electric car graveyards, and the cars are all fairly new, but the batteries have run out. And the cars are just need to be scrapped. And then what are they going to do with these batteries? They're highly toxic, and they have to get rid of them somehow. How are they going to do that? Well, they don't know. So they've just got all these cars just sat there, not knowing what to do with them. It's all back to front, the way that we are looking at these things and doing them. I don't know if you want to add to that, Max, or should we move on?
I think we've said as much as we can on that. Let's move on.
Well, let's move into our greatest Britain. Should we move into greatest Britain's, Max?
Yes, let's do that. Let's talk about something positive.
Yeah, and he really is positive, this greatest Briton of ours that we have been discussing. We will be talking about Lord Leverhulme, William Hesketh Lever, and we'll start with a recap. Last episode, we heard how Lever took the press to court and had them admitting defeat before he had even finished being cross-examined by the lawyers. He gave the money he made in compensation to universities and other worthy causes, not keeping any of it for himself or for his company. He then moved into Africa, building a replica Port Sunlight for the Congolese that he thought was even better than the first one. But the natives did not understand what was so good about it, and they did not want to give up their simple lives for one that required responsibility. Because of this, the Belgian government provided the labour to him for his venture, and since they were later accused of mistreating the natives, Lever's name has also become associated with this. But no mistreatment of employees would have gone on with his knowledge, because everything he did was for his employees' benefit. And then this week we're going to hear about his adventures in Scotland, but do you want to add anything to that recap first, Max?
Well, just that when we discussed this last week, we mentioned about the sort of cultural difference in the concept of time, where there is the sort of white Western concept of time being what's generally termed by scientists nowadays as technological time, where time is a linear thing, where human beings evolved and civilization was created, and each successive generation of civilization built on the shoulders of the people beforehand, so that civilization was a progression. And this is the way in which history used to be taught, that civilization started off with very primitive ways of life and then progressed, and that the way that we in the West lead our lives nowadays used to be regarded as the pinnacle of the progress of Western civilization, and people look forward to greater progress being made in the future, so that things could become even better than they had been in the past. Whereas as far as indigenous populations are concerned, probably like the indigenous population of the Congo, they would have had a different concept of time, what evolutionary psychologists call ceremonial time or dream time. You often hear of Aboriginal natives from Australia talking about dream time, and this is a concept of a cyclical concept of time, where each day is a repeat of the previous day, each month is a repeat of the previous month, each year is a repeat of the previous year, and where people strive to live in harmony with their environment by never striving for more, effectively. And it's kind of like a civilization built upon the concept of Groundhog Day, where you don't change the way that you live, because otherwise it will disturb the ecological balance of these indigenous people living in a state of nature, and that the problem faced by the Belgians and also by Leverhulme in the Congo was would have been, in my view, largely as a result of the two different concepts between the West and the Aboriginal peoples of the Congo, and where there was strife caused, and where perhaps there was some coercion of the Africans to make them work in the way that the Belgian government wanted, it would have been as a result of that.
That's what would have looked bad on Leverhulme. I was just thinking there when you were saying that, Max. I think actually Christianity actually played a part in getting us to see ourselves as advancing from one place to another, because it had all these prophecies in the Bible about these great empires that were to come and things that were to come in the future, which I don't think we'd really sort of had before. I guess we sort of knew about Ragnarok, but not in such detail. I mean, Dr. E. Michael Jones has talked about this and how that way of looking at things mixed with the Greek philosophical way of looking at things, which gave us Christianity. And obviously the Congolese didn't experience any of that. They were just experiencing what was going on from one day to the next, and they didn't want to complicate their simple lives, I guess. Well, moving back to Britain and Scotland, in May 1918, by then in semi-retirement, Baron Leverhulme, as he was now known, bought the Isle of Lewis for £167,000. And in late 1919, he bought the estate of South Harris for £36,000, both of them in the Outer Hebrides, Scotland. And, I mean, that's quite incredible. He was able to actually buy an island. I didn't know that you could do that. You sort of imagine that they're owned by the government if they've got people that are living on them. But have you heard of this before, Max, being able to just buy an island in Britain?
Yeah, I have heard of people buying islands. The prices nowadays, though, are considerably higher than they were in Lord Leverhulme's day. I mean, you'd be looking at something like 167 million, I would think, to buy even an island much smaller than the Island of Lewis. I mean, the Isle of Lewis would probably be an astronomical amount you'd have to pay for that nowadays. But you get people that also buy these. During the Second World War, there were forts that were built in the shallow seas around the coast of Britain that were then manned by sort of cannons and machine guns, etc., to deter invasion. And you do occasionally hear of people of those coming up for sale as well, and so people buy those and then convert them into plush offshore homes. And I can imagine that there will be lots of people who've been who've become fabulously wealthy for one reason or another, who will look around and think, oh yeah, it'd be very nice to have an island that would keep the hoi polloi from my door, and they would do that.
Well, it looks like Lever bought this island because he wanted to improve the lives of the people that were on it. His plans for their future prosperity centered upon the application of modern science and his own business skills in establishing a large and thriving fishing industry. And of course, there is already a fishing industry in Scotland, but he wanted to completely reimagine it. Lord Leverhulme intended that the port should be improved and enlarged to attract landings of fish from visiting vessels to supplement the catches made by local boats, and his own fleet of modern drifters and trawlers. There would be an ice-making factory and cargo vessels with refrigerated holds to take the fresh fish to a depot on the British mainland at Fleetwood, Lancashire, which was well-placed to serve the industrial towns of the north of England. Leverhulme also expanded the herring curing capacity and enlarged the fish processing facilities with the installation of a canning factory and a plant to make fish cakes, fish paste, glue, animal feed and fertiliser, with similar equipment being established at Fleetwood. And we often forget, you know, we were talking about natural resources earlier. One of our greatest natural resources that we've always had is all the fish that we have that surround us. And it's quite amazing, really, that we aren't more involved in the actual eating of this fish. The vast majority of it gets exported to Europe rather than by us eating it, I guess, where we're surrounded by it all the time. So he's basically setting up this big improvement to the fish industry. Typically, Leverhulme's business strategies were comprehensive and meticulously set out. His plans for the island called for a reliable workforce. But although the inhabitants of Stornoway were generally well-educated and hard-working, they were for the most part regularly employed and well-paid. The largely Gaelic-speaking crofters, on the other hand, were mainly subsistence farmers, and many of them were squatters. And it was this section of the population that Leverhulme hoped to develop and recruit. The crofters were poor, but they were used to an independent lifestyle that was both long-established and deeply ingrained in their psyche. Nevertheless, Leverhulme planned to entice them into becoming carbon copies of his Lancashire artisans by offering them an attractive alternative to their meagre small holdings. He did not actively oppose the crofter's way of life, but neither did he support it as some thought that he, as their patron, ought to have done. When the crofters learned about the money that was being expended on other projects, they began to resent his lack of support for them. And I don't think it was so much that he wasn't supporting them. I think he was looking at what they were doing and he was thinking, well, this isn't going to be financially viable in the future. We need to set something up for these people that they, something different that they can learn to do so that they can still stay here in this island with the way of life that they've had for many, many years, but they need to be doing something productive and they need some way of earning money. Otherwise, all of that is going to be lost. So he was really putting them first, I think, by setting all of this up for them. But they were, again, they weren't able to see that far ahead. And they were thinking, well, why isn't he supporting the crofting? Well, because the crofting isn't financially viable. And I think when we look at the amount of crofters that there are now, we can see why he was doing this. Because if they had taken him up on this, they would all still be able to be living in these islands, which I think now they're pretty much priced out of living there. It's the rich that want to go and live in these rural places, the same as throughout Britain. In the most beautiful rural places that used to be the cheapest places to live have now become some of the most expensive places to live. And the locals that have lived there for centuries can no longer buy a house there. You know, I'm thinking of particularly of Cornwall here, where nobody can afford to live in Cornwall anymore that's actually Cornish born and bred. Do you want to add anything to that, Max?
Well, just that the same kind of psychology was involved as far as the crofters are concerned. If you're a subsistence farmer, and it's not just the Scots crofters that sort of fell into this same trap, there would have been similar subsistence farmers in other parts of the British Isles and also in other parts of Europe. And the point is that subsistence is, or the subsistence concept is the same concept of trying to keep the way that you live in harmony with your natural environment. And once you reach a point where you are fully exploiting your natural environment, then you won't change anything, because otherwise it will disturb the balance and it will prevent you from subsisting from the natural environment. And so that then tends to cause the people that live that way to fall behind relative to those people who are striving for more, striving to do things better, striving to expand and advance civilization. And so as far as those, and you're absolutely right, as far as those subsistence farmers are concerned, had they tried to remain as subsistence economies, then they would eventually have been outstripped by other people producing the same thing that they produce, but on the mainland, where they would perhaps have more automated techniques, etc. Unless you introduce legislation to preserve the kind of skills that are involved in the hand making of things, and I can see that there are perhaps two markets. One market being for handmade goods, which would tend to be very expensive, and the other market for machine made goods, which would tend to be less expensive, but by comparison. And you can see that where something and this. This is an issue which is interlinked with the issue that we spoke about previously with one of our previous Greatest Britons, where we were talking about the fulfillment that people get from manufacturing, where somebody who actually is part of a team of people who make a complete car, who take all the component parts of a car, who actually make the component parts of a car and then bolt them all together to make a car, you get far more fulfillment out of doing that than you would do if you were the person who puts the third screw in from the left on the engine as the car comes past you on an assembly line. And so that there is a balance to be had, I think, because there is something to be said for the the sort of slower pace of life that exists within a subsistence economy, there is something to be said from the point of view of creating from a mental health point of view. But on the other hand, there has to be a balance so that the subsistence way of life isn't so intensively followed and so restrictively followed that it means that the people that follow that way of life become left behind by the rest of civilization.
Yeah, I mean, these farmers, they could have kept on doing some of the subsistence farming, but also working in the new fish factories and on the port there and on the docks and getting involved in that and still stayed where they were. I mean, it's very sad what's happened to the crofting. And I think he was looking ahead and thinking, well, they could do both and this would preserve this. But they just didn't understand that. Leverhulme did his utmost to woo the population of Lewis and to make himself, as well as his schemes, popular among all the islanders. This seems to have worked to some extent, but there were other sceptics whose voices were heard in government circles. Robert Munro, the Secretary of State for Scotland, and Donald Murray, the MP for the Western Isles, as well as a number of supporting characters, including most of the House of Commons, were anxious to redress past oppression of the Highlanders, who had so recently served with outstanding bravery in the First World War. The Small Landholders of Scotland Act 1911 had empowered the Scottish Secretary on behalf of His Majesty's Government to acquire certain farms in the Highlands and Islands by compulsory purchase and to have them divided up to provide more crofts. In 1913, four farms on Lewis had been scheduled for takeover, but the action had been opposed by the proprietor at that time, and when the war with Germany broke out, it was left in abeyance. Towards the end of the war, in the summer of 1918, the Scottish office first proposed to Leverhulme that under the Small Landholders Act, the Board of Agriculture should take possession of certain of his farms and create something fewer than 150 crofts. Leverhulme was against this, even though some local politicians believed that Leverhulme's project and the provision of more crofts were not mutually exclusive. But Leverhulme firmly believed that he could greatly improve living standards to an extent that crofting would become a forgotten way of life. He was also impatient with politicians' machinations and the laborious indolence of the political system that persisted with the, quote, futile land reform, instead of adopting what he considered the most sensible course of action, to forget about new crofts and allow him, in the interests of expediency, to behave like the monarch of the Western Isles. So, I mean, we have to remember, I mean, he is an eccentric and he did name places after him, but he did put the needs of the people that were his employees above everything else. So he's saying, we don't want to have new crofts here. We want to build a way of life for these people that is actually going to fund them, because these crofts are not financially viable, whereas the government are saying, well, we want to reward people that have been fighting in the war by giving them these crofts, and they wanted to take one of his farms to actually do this. Were you aware of this before, Max? The government actually wanting to help out or make amends for the Highland clearances or any of this that was going on before the war and after?
I wasn't specifically aware of this, no, but I mean, it's again, all of what you've just outlined to us supports what I said about there needing to be a balance between the personal fulfillment that people get through hand making things in a subsistence way, and the needs of providing what's the word I'm thinking of here? It's sustainability as a result of technological advances and organizing their society in a more efficient way. And so to a certain extent, I think Lord Leverhulme was going perhaps a bit too far and a bit too fast. And he perhaps needed to slow down and then bring the people who were wanting to promote the crofting way of life with him. But the point is that Lord Leverhulme eventually lost out in this. And so what's now happened is that the the crofting cottage industries that previously existed in the Highlands of Scotland and in the Hebrides, etc., they have become pretty much anachronistic. And the young people being born into these into the communities that exist on those islands have left Scotland, and that's why population of Scotland has dwindled somewhat, or hasn't grown to any great extent. And this is why the current Prime Minister of Scotland is so keen to have immigrants going to Scotland, because to make up for the fact that young people, when they reach the age at which they can leave home, tend to leave home and come to move south or move into the big cities in Scotland in order to make a career, because there isn't a career for them in the Highlands of the Islands of Scotland. Had more people had more emphasis been given to Lord Leverhulme, then there probably would still be viable industries in the Highlands and Islands of Scotland, and there wouldn't be such a problem with the sort of brain drain of the young leaving in order to make their fortunes elsewhere.
That's the really sad thing, isn't it? I mean, he lost out, and as a result, the people of the Hebrides ended up losing out. The crofters ended up losing out, because they didn't just end up losing their way of life. They ended up losing any way of doing anything else, and they had to move out, or their children did. Thus, by the beginning of 1919, the positions taken up by those involved were fairly well defined. Robert Munro, himself a Highlander, believed passionately in the reinstatement of the crofts, and he also felt strongly that the Imperial Parliament at Westminster was unlikely to tolerate any departure from the implementation of land reform. But he saw no reason why Lewis should not have Leverhulme's industrial schemes as well as more crofts. Leverhulme refused to budge, believing that the breakup of his farms would lead to seriously inefficient, probably unsustainable, and ultimately abandoned smallholdings, as crofters moved away in search of better incomes. Ranged against this, at least ostensibly reasonable prediction, was the formidable influence wielded by prospective crofters away fighting in France, as well as by supporters of the Highland League, which was politically dedicated to land reform. So you've actually got people that are away fighting the war that have been told that they're going to be given farms when they come back. I know they built these houses for a lot of the people that fought in the First World War. They called them homes for heroes. I didn't realise they were sort of giving them away farms as well, and making all these promises to them. Do you know much about that?
I don't know that the farms would have been given away, but that they probably would have been made available on advantageous terms. I know that in a lot of the Highlands and Islands of Scotland, there are bylaws that exist. I think they're bylaws. They may be more sort of widespread than that. But the where in order to buy a croft, you have to be born of a crofting family, effectively. So it's an attempt to sort of try and maintain the communities in the Highlands by introducing that kind of situation. But all that does is that stops other people from other parts of the country who might actually like the idea of leading a crofting lifestyle, of moving to these islands and sustaining and maintaining the population levels there. And this whole issue is core to the reason why Scotland has become depopulated, and why there are large tracts of Scotland where there's very, very sparse population, because of resistance to people like Lord Leverhulme, who, insofar as he went a little bit too far, a little bit too fast, I can accept that. That may well be there may be some justification for that attitude, but at the end of the day, there needed to be industries that were on a sufficient scale so that they could manufacture goods and produce products at a cost that would keep them viable for the future, so that there would continue to be work there for young people and for the people who are crofters.
Well, I think we also see similar animosities today, don't we? Or we did do to Donald Trump, who was trying to set up golf courses and bring lots of business to Scotland. And we saw this big movement against him, basically, all this animosity against him when he was really trying to help the Scots out. And I must say it's very commendable of this Robert Munro, the loyalty that he shows to his fellow Highlanders. But it was misplaced in the plans that he actually had for them. In early March 1919, men started to take over Leverholm's farms on Lewis. They drove off the farmers' livestock, demolished boundary walls, and staked out 6-acre plots. By the summer, 16 out of the 22 farms on the island had been affected. Expecting Leverholm's approval, the raiders were taken aback when he voiced his complete condemnation of their actions and asked them to withdraw from his land. Some left, but others erected shelters for their families on the stolen plots. Leverholm was evidently not willing to prosecute ex-servicemen who were trying to secure homes for their families, and it seems unlikely that under the circumstances legal action would have succeeded. Instead, he toured Lewis trying to persuade them that their future lay with him and not in the crofting system. They were, however, extremely reluctant to abandon the old ways, and most of them continued to espouse the crofting way of life. So he's basically got big enough farms that are actually financially viable, and what they've done is break them all down into 6-acre plots which are not financially viable, and they're squatting, and instead of taking them to court, because he doesn't want to do that, because these men have just fought in the war and they're just trying to provide for their families. So he's trying to say, well, look, you can provide for your families by working in the way that I'm trying to set up here, which will last for generations. But they didn't want to listen. And this is the first I've heard of this, stealing farms and all this excitement going on up in the Hebrides.
I wasn't quite as aware of all of that, those aspects as perhaps I might be as well. And but it still illustrates the this dichotomy between the sort of technological time and sort of ceremonial time or whatever, where indigenous, because the crofters would have been the indigenous people of the Highlands and Islands of Scotland. And it was that they wanted to maintain the crofting lifestyle, because that would then mean that they would live in the same way that their parents lived, and would retain the same culture. And you can understand, that sort of a lifestyle would have its attractions. However, the passage of time has shown that that if you have too extreme a desire to resist change in order to retain your old way of life, that it does then have a detrimental effect, because you then find yourself in competition with people who are producing things on an industrial scale, and from a price perspective, you can't hold your own. So there is some joy to be had from leading a sort of a crofting lifestyle. And when we were speaking about it before, and going back to the analogy of people building a car from scratch, you do get a great sense of satisfaction out of hand making something, and that there should always be a market for handmade goods that are made with the skill of a craftsman's eye and the skill of a craftsman's hands. But they will always have to be very, very expensive in order to create a business model that would make it profitable to produce those. If you're going to compete with people that are making machine finished goods or machine manufactured goods for the mass market, then you're always going to be priced out of the market if you try to retain a crofting lifestyle that isn't supported by the sort of higher prices that hand making things demands or commands.
Yeah, I think he certainly had sympathy for their way of life. I mean, he's had his farm stolen from him, and he's not sort of fighting back or anything. He's just trying to say to them, well, look, this isn't the best way of going about doing things. Well, attitudes began to harden and polarise, culminating in politicians pressing ahead with land reform and Leverholm demanding a 10-year moratorium, coupled with a thinly veiled threat to withdraw from his schemes. In early 1920, upon his return from a business trip to the States, Leverholm learned that the raiding had continued during his absence. By this time, serious financial difficulties were besetting Lever Brothers concerning the disastrous Niger Company, making his decision about the Western Isles project relatively straightforward. With a pressing need to make significant savings, he announced his intention to concentrate his efforts on Stornoway and on Harris, and that all work in the country area of Lewis would be abandoned forthwith. So you think about that. I mean, he's put a lot of money into this as well, trying to sort this out, provide an income for these people in the years to come. And he's lost all of that. And he's also lost all his properties there. The population of Harris was smaller in size and more scattered than that of Lewis. Consequently, Leverhulme's plans advanced there with very few problems. With permission from the locals, the fishing village of Obby was renamed Leverborough. On the 3rd of September 1923, Viscount Leverhulme, as he had become the previous year, addressed the Stornoway Council and the Lewis District Council at a meeting which he had asked to be specially convened on that date. Lord Leverhulme asked them to take the land and make their system work. But only Stornoway, always on Leverhulme's side, accepted the gift, set up the trust, and to a large extent made it work for the benefit of the town. Left with so much of the island that he no longer wanted, Leverhulme sold off as much as he could, but many of the buyers were interested principally in shooting and fishing. So basically, the crofters ended up losing out. Leverhulme ended up losing out. He just gave the island to them, basically. He said, look, you can have the island and make your system work. You can have it. But they did not, or some of them set up the gift, but the rest of them didn't, I think, is what it is saying here. He asked them to take the land and make their system work, but only Stornoway accepted the gift and set up the trust. So the rest of them didn't. And sadly, very soon afterwards, Leverhulme died. He died in May 1925. And soon after that, the board of Lever Brothers gave orders for all the development on Harris to stop too. And so Leverhulme's scheme for the Western Isles perished with almost nothing achieved there. I mean, that is very sad. So if we just finish up by taking a look at his legacy here. Before he died, he was made High Sheriff of Lancashire in 1917, and in November 1918, Leverhulme was invited to become the Mayor of Bolton because the council wanted to honour a notable son of the town as a mark of the high regard the citizens of Bolton had for him. He was elevated to the Viscountcy on 27th of November 1922 and died at the age of 73 of pneumonia at his home in Hampstead on the 7th of May 1925. And some people would say, well, he always used to sleep in the open air. He used to literally remove the windows from the houses that he was sleeping in the bedroom, so it was always open to the fresh air. And some people would suggest that may have caused this pneumonia, but I would have thought that he would have built up a resistance to things like that, and a resistance to the cold. I mean, we used to live without central heating and we managed to survive. So that was just one of his eccentricities. And his wife also died of pneumonia as well some years before. His funeral was attended by 30,000 people. And that's a lot of people. And isn't it? I mean, that's massive. And he is buried in the churchyard of Christ Church in Port Sunlight in what was then Cheshire and is now Merseyside. He was succeeded by his son, William Lever, 2nd Viscount Leverhulme. He was a major benefactor to his native town Bolton, where he was made a freeman of the county borough in 1902. In 1899, he bought Hall Itherwood, one-time home of Samuel Crompton, and restored it as a museum for the town. He donated 360 acres of land and landscaped Lever Park in Rivington in 1902. He was responsible for the formation of Bolton School, after re-endowing Bolton Grammar School and Bolton High School for Girls in 1913. He donated the land for Bolton's largest park, Leverhulme Park, in 1914. And in 1920, he donated £50 to the Selborne Society campaign to purchase land in West London as the Gilbert White Memorial. It is now known as the Perivale Wood Local Nature Reserve. He endowed a school of tropical medicine at Liverpool University, gave Lancaster House in London to the British nation, and endowed the Leverholm Trust, set up to provide funding for education and research. The Trust in 2017 became benefactor to Rivington and Blackrod High School and Harper Green School, both becoming Leverholm Church of England Academies in Bolton. The garden of his former London residence, The Hill in Hampstead, designed by Thomas Mawson, is open to the public and has been renamed Inverforth House. A blue plaque at Inverforth House commemorating Leverholm was unveiled by his great-granddaughter, Jane Heber Percy, in 2002. He also built many houses in Thornton Hof, which became a model village comparable to Port Sunlight, and in 1906 he built St George's United Reformed Church. The Lady Lever Art Gallery opened in 1922 and is in the Port Sunlight Conservation Area. Much of Leverholm's art collection is displayed in the gallery, which houses one of the finest collections formed by an industrialist in England. And Port Sunlight is still there today. People can go and visit it, go and have a look around it. It's part of a conservation area there. I mean, we can see here that he didn't just look after his employees. He looked after everybody else around him and all the people that he lived with when he was brought up in Bolton. A really, really nice guy, a genuine British eccentric that really put it into practice, this idea of wanting to do your best for your people. And he really did succeed in doing that. You got any final thoughts on Lord Lever here, Max?
Oh, just a great benefactor, really. And I think that the undoing of his plans in Scotland were, you know, as I said, probably as a result of moving a little bit too fast for people. Perhaps he could have tried to incorporate elements of the crofting communities and society that existed on those islands into his plans a little bit more to make the his ideas a little bit more palatable to the people of the islands. And it's quite sad that everything came to naught at the end of the day. And that as a result of that, the industries that could have been sustained in the Highlands and Islands of Scotland have dwindled away. And the populations of those areas have become much sparser than they might otherwise have been. But, you know, when you look at all of the endowments that he made, when you look at all of the gifts that he gave to various groups and to various schools and places of science, etc., you know, he definitely was a great man and somebody that whose life should serve as a model to other people nowadays.
Yeah, especially if you're an employer. I mean, or you run a business. This is the sort of man who you want to follow in his footsteps and look after your employees. It's just such a great shame that you know, the crofters and the Congolese were not as far. They couldn't see as further forward in time as he did. They just weren't as visionary as he was. But yeah, he definitely deserves to be in our greatest Britons. And I'm very thankful to Michael Woodbridge for suggesting him to us. If anybody else has any suggestions for Greatest Britons that we should cover, then please do let us know. Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Max.
It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.